Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Well, we are going to be, through the magic of technology, going to be traveling to Alaska. Now, for those of you that have listened to me over the years, you know how significant Alaska is to me. Alaska has been like a second home. But I discovered about, well, just a few weeks ago, about a woman, Linda Fritz, who has written a book, Answering Alaska's Call. Now, this is about a man, Milo Fritz, who is a character bigger than life in some respects, but in others, an amazing man that was able to go up into the far north, creating opportunity, change, and having something like a sense of adventure, that it was more like massive curiosity about an environment that he just passionately fell in love with and served the people in the state of Alaska in an incredible way. Linda Fritz, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. I'm pleased to be here to talk about Alaska and Doc Fritz.
Well, I can understand why. Milo Doc Fritz. This is a man who came from an East Coast environment and ended up finding himself going into the medical area. But you were a member of that Fritz family. How is it that you got the job assignment of, well, telling his story?
Well, I'm his niece, and I have been aware of his story for many years since I was a young girl, actually. He used to come visit us in Marion, Pennsylvania, when he came east for some of his medical meetings, conferences, training. And he would come by, and we would be regaled with stories of Alaska. He had trinkets and crafts and things he would send us, Gold Flake story, things like that, periodically through the course of my childhood growing up. And he would also send letters to my father, who was his brother, that would often be posted on the refrigerator about what was going on in his day or his week. They wrote each other pretty much weekly. And so I had a sense of his life early on. And then in 1966, he asked me to come up to Alaska to work with him and his wife, my Aunt Betsy, in their Anchorage-based medical practice and go on several clinics throughout the summer with them. And it was a great opportunity. I'm a very interested in travel. At that point, I'd already been a journalist for my local newspaper, reporting on what was going on in my junior high on a weekly basis. So I was used to finding stories and reporting on them for the general public. And I just knew and recognized early on this is a fabulous man, a fabulous story. And I went up there knowing I had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go to Alaska and to be part of this terrific practice that he was doing. It was very much on the cutting edge of everything. And I just took a lot of notes. I had a journal. I took lots of photographs. And I just had a marvelous, very educational time. It opened me up to the possibilities of Alaska, which were tremendous.
I can imagine. Now, when he was able to go to Alaska, it was the very first time he literally fell in love with it. And
absolutely.
When he came home, he basically told Betsy, your Aunt Betsy, that his wife, that I'm going back. I don't know whether you're going to go with me or not, but I'm going. And then saying he was glad to be home. But there is that feeling. And there was just this opportunity for him to expand into something that he really felt that he could do. It was a calling, and it gave him the opportunity to step into environments that a lot of the doctors that he had been around, other than those in, I think it was North Carolina, where he served. And my goodness, the sad thing is a lot of the things that went on in North Carolina, because of the poverty of people there, it was very much the same up in Alaska. It really helped to prepare him for this. But there's history that goes on earlier. What made him decide to become a doctor? This is a man that had so many interests and such a drive of curiosity.
Yes, it goes back to the time he told me when he was a young boy and their doctor still made health calls. And he'd fallen and cut his wrist on a beer bottle as they were moving out of one house into another one. And the doctor came in and stitched up his wrist. He still had the scar that he showed me many, many years later. And at that point, he decided, that's what I want to do with my life. I would like to be a surgeon and a doctor. And he didn't really waver from that point on, except briefly he was interested in being an aviator because of Lindbergh, when Lindbergh made his transatlantic flight. He briefly thought that might be a good thing to do. But other than that, he was in love with medicine from a very early age. He soon became in love with Alaska, and after that, flying, and of course, all the way through since he was in medical school or in his residency at Duke, when he and my aunt got married, he and Betsy were a dynamic duo. They were just a real partnership, a love marriage and a business partnership. And they went through incredible challenges together. So part of this book is about a very enduring love story that endured all kinds of challenges, including the challenges of Alaska.
Oh, yes. And those were big. Those were huge. Now, he came from a family where stubbornness is known, and it was a German family. And you go into a little bit of the family history. And when he decided to do things on his own, it was sort of a tradition among the Fritzes in this family line that they would ignore previous generations and go and do whatever they wanted to do. And Milo was exactly the same, and his father disowned him to a degree.
Yep.
I mean, to a degree.
I mean, not really disowned him, but they definitely had their frictions, and they also worked together on something. My grandfather was an artist, and at some point he was doing drawings of some of the experimental and research work that my uncle was doing. So there was a back and forth relationship, whether they were up or down, and just different things might be compatible with each other, and other times they were at odds.
He was in Alaska for a lot of years, but he was in the military, and that took him to Alaska. And there were many things that he saw there. Now, this was in the 40s. Am I correct in remembering that?
Yes,
Okay.
Well, he first went up to Alaska with Aunt Betsy right out of his residency at Duke. He became an eye, ear, nose, and throat specialist at Duke, and then went up to Alaska to address the terrible eye, ear, nose, and throat problems of the indigenous communities up there. And so they went up together initially on a grand adventure across country, up through Seattle and on into Ketchikan. And for a year or so, were taken by Alaska. And then he had already been a reserve officer in the Army. And after about a year in Ketchikan, he was called back to New York State, and he had to serve in the military at that point, and which he was happy to do. And there was an opportunity where they asked him, "Any fellows want to go to Alaska?" And he said, his hand shot up, and before they could change their mind, they had his papers cut. So he was very happy to go back up there again.
And that put him on a trajectory in his life that was phenomenal. This information that you have here in your book talks about a time when tuberculosis was rampant. And the native people, they had serious nutritional deficiencies as well, because they did not have access to quote-unquote vegetables. They might for a tiny bit of time, you know, maybe 3 months out of the year, but mostly the environment that they were living in, the sanitation situations were not good. And he saw all kinds of things that went on. And there's this awareness, and though he was, an eye, ear, nose, throat specialist, there were so many other things that he had to contend with. And this just really, by the time that he served in North Carolina, that enabled him to adapt to what was necessary. We're talking about an environment that is so rugged and so difficult. I mean, she was just finding out about what he and Betsy went through going into Alaska, driving by car. But what they experienced was this camaraderie. Wherever they were, there was this willingness for people to help each other, because the Alaskan environment, even today, the Alaskan environment is a very rugged one. It is a tough one, and weather changes can be in within minutes. And you can't take anything for granted.
No, I mean, the flying conditions can change. He was a very careful pilot, but he was, you know, there was bad conditions reported, he just wouldn't go. They're old pilots and bold pilots, but they're old pilots, is the old refrain. And Alaskans depend upon each other to help each other. And there's that sense of camaraderie, as you mentioned. There's a can-do spirit. There's a resourcefulness that he had to employ, because he'd show up at one of these small villages and operate in a school or a community center or something like that, and just with the most primitive conditions. And he would make it work, and he would also incorporate the help of the villagers to act as the teenage girls that sometimes help with the operations. He would train them. Betsy would train them, depending upon if she was with him or not. The teenage boys would be the ambulance crew, run people back and forth from their homes back to wherever they're set up their operations. So Alaska's got a great sense of independence, but also that sense that you need your neighbors, and you depend upon your neighbors from time to time. And people are very willing to help. I've even had an experience where they didn't like somebody, but he said, if that guy breaks down somewhere, I'm going to have to help him, even though I don't like him, because you might be the last person who's available to help them.
Mm-hmm. There is that resourcefulness and that camaraderie. It's really quite a place, even today, with all of the modern things that we have and experience up there. It still is very much the same way. And he encountered, when he was up in Alaska, he would get bureaucrats coming in from Washington or different areas, and he would say, you don't understand what we've got here. And one of the biggest challenges he had was with, especially with the natives, but even other people that lived in Alaska. There was tuberculosis. There was no vaccine for TB at the time. And you had diphtheria. You had typhoid, you had all kinds of diseases, and this is something that today often people don't realize. There is still this challenge because of immune systems, just like we experienced during COVID, immune systems that just don't have what it takes to fight a foreign invader.
Right.
So
that's part of why he was successful in being able to operate even under those primitive conditions, because the same germs, the same environment they're used to, they didn't go to an outside hospital to have those operations. So they're all within their own germ pool, I guess. And so he never lost a patient, even though he worked under very trying conditions.
Mm-hmm.
He was very resourceful and also very careful, as you said. He always took a very careful history of everyone to make sure he wasn't trying to do something that wasn't going to work. If somebody bled a lot when they had a tooth pulled or something like that, he did not pursue the operation. And he didn't do operations out in the bush that were complicated ones, like mastoidectomies, which were very complicated operations. He would do those in the local hospital if there was one, or have the patient come in to the local, whatever the closest town was.
Yeah, often Seattle.
In a hospital.
Yes, they'd often fly down to Seattle. The plane.
Yes, or Anchorage, or depending on where the problem was. Initially, yes, Seattle was a place where a lot of people went. And then as time went on, then there are other places that had good hospitals and good care. But he would only do like tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies adenoidectomies were the common operation he performed, because you could, he said, if you could catch them before the ears break down, you could save the hearing in those cases. And a lot of these things would fester. If they weren't treated, you would take a common cold or something that was relatively minor, and if it just festered and wasn't dealt with for years on end, it could affect your eyes or ears and the way of life, or quality of life, because it depended on hunting and fishing and outdoor activities to just have a normal life up there.
Mm-hmm. Very, very true. He was in the Aleutians for the Alaskan Forgotten War. It was the only World War II campaign that was fought on American soil, and I don't think that that's even taught in history classes unless you are up in Alaska.
That's why it's a forgotten war. Yes, no one knew what happened.
Mm-hmm. So this, there were so many people that you recognized, and that in the files, your Aunt Betsy, his wife, really was so significant because she kept records on everything. She had diaries. She kept all of these things, and they were organized and filed. Now, when you were compiling this, this is a man that you had admired when you were a little girl and when you had a chance to go up and to be in Alaska and to work with him, and your Aunt Betsy, she survived him.
Yeah.
But how old was he when he died?
I think he was 91, I believe. He was born in 1909 and died in 2000. So, yes, 1909, yes, 91.
Mm-hmm. And she lived.
But she survived him after that. But yes, they kept tremendous records, tremendous archives. They were, when I went up to see her for the end of her life and saw the archives that were in a three-bay garage and took up all that space, there were no patient records at that time. They'd been disposed of for privacy reasons, but there were reprints of articles he'd written, many, many articles for publications, both medical and other publications, correspondence, diaries, scrapbooks, just a tremendous amount of material that he had been saving. He would plan to write his own biography, his autobiography, and so these were being kept for that purpose. And then as he got older and he had to keep working financially to keep going, he had less time to spend on that. And it became too overwhelming a job. He had lived too full a life, and the records were just enormous. And he just couldn't do it, and he couldn't afford to have somebody come in and do it, which was recommended to him by some people. But it would have required someone of great talent to come in and basically live with them for quite a while to go through that material.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a tremendous amount. It was the third biggest archive in Alaska after Ted Stevens and the Atwood collection, Atwood Archive.
Mm-hmm. This is something that when you think about what he did in his lifetime, and he lived to be in his 90s, but he always had this feeling of urgency.
Yes.
That you convey in the book. It's like, I've got to do things now. And that doing it now kind of a attitude. I mean, he worked long hours. We will hear of nurses and doctors. We heard the stories many times working 16 hours, 18-hour days. Some people, like during COVID, 24 hours without any sleep. Just going one right after the other, you know, 1 hour right after the other, and him being so exhausted. But there was that feel that he had all the time that you have to do it now. You have to do it now. You don't wait. You do it now. That was very strong in him, wasn't it?
Yes. He had a sense of urgency that was just amazing, and a capacity for work that was amazing. But he had... And that was part of why he went out and did the clinics in the bush, because he would see on Thursdays, they would devote Thursdays to Alaska Native populations coming in who needed care. And that was just a drop in the bucket. That didn't begin to address the problem. So that's why he started to go out into the bush. First with mail planes, going out with them, it became inconvenient and expensive. And then finally, in the early 50s, he learned how to fly and had his own plane and could go more economically out to these remote areas. But there was just so much to do, and he felt so bad for the problems that were out there. And he just tried to do what he could and also address, help other people to do that. And he relied heavily on the public health nurses, who he said were magnificent people. He had great respect for them because they were on the ground. If there were any in that any village, they were the ones who knew what was going on and would you know sort of brief him on the situations there. And there was just overwhelming. They've been this population had been totally neglected, and he was there to do what he could to address that problem. But it was overwhelming for one person to do.
He ended up going into Washington D.C. and petitioning for health assistance in the state of Alaska. He said, we have, you know, and there was another doctor that said the same thing. The conditions for treating people in that state were appallingly bad. And that's one of the reasons he attained the reputation, because he said, and I'm going to quote what he said in 1937, Alaska, where Larry, which is his brother, and our wives, and I hope to live and grow up with the country, my mad dream of a medical air service to all settlements seemed not mad at all. Well, I know from personal experience, there's areas you cannot get to without having a plane. You just cannot. And he really had some good tutoring on this, and that is it's one of the reasons he took it up. It was just what you did so that you could get to where you wanted to go.
Yes. He was a visionary. He saw the need, and he was very resourceful about how to address the problem. And flying was a solution, one of the solutions to it. And he loved to fly, so it gave him a reason to fly and be helpful and to bring medical care to people that could not afford to come to Anchorage or wherever the local hospital might be. So he went out to them to see what he could do to address some of those more simple problems and keep them from getting worse. And the major problems would have to come into a real hospital or a real clinic of some sort.
Mm-hmm. And that would sometimes have its own challenges due to the difference in the environment and with their immune system. So you had a number of things that were going on. And this is your book, Answering Alaska's Call, gives a view into the realities of what physicians have to deal with when they go into different environments. And Alaska is a world unto itself. It is a magnificent world, but it is a very rugged world. And so often we forget, especially those of us in the lower 48, as we are called, this is something that's very difficult for a lot of people to really understand. Now, they may take a cruise trip and go up through the waters, but they still have all the conveniences, and they have no idea what it's like to do construction, to be able to survive in the changing weather environments, which can be quite brutal. You have all of this to contend with, and they have their droughts up there. The environment, I think, that he and Betsy and their children were in really is a pioneer environment in many respects, even today.
Yes. What's still called the land of the last frontier. Sure, there are towns, but they're scattered, you know, towns, cities. But the rest of the state, as you know, is just huge. And when you superimpose Texas on it, you begin to get the sense of scale, or the United States. You begin to see how big it is. And it's just, it's remote. I mean, there are a lot of just remote places. There's no way around it. And it's a challenge to live out there, and it takes a pioneering spirit to make a go of it. I've never been up to Alaska in the winter, but I had an opportunity when I was 16 to stay on. My aunt and uncle asked if I wanted to stay on and go to high school there. I was all for it, so I didn't know what I would be getting into, but my parents had told me to come home, so that squashed that idea. But I don't know if I could have survived successfully a long, dark winter in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And while they have lots of sun all summer long, and there were no goat, they never go, no, no one ever knows when to go to sleep. As my uncle told me when I landed, I laughed and go around with circles under their eyes in the summer. But in the winter, the reverse of that is, of course, a lot of darkness.
Very true. And that exists, obviously, even today. The challenges that he went through, and in working with legislature, I think even today there are those challenges because people do not associate Alaska with the lower 48, and it is a world unto itself. When you were writing this book and when you were going through those publications and informations and the historical research you did relative to the time frame, how did this affect you? You mean, this is your Uncle Fritz. This is someone you had spent time with. You had a great deal of respect for. How did it affect you when you found out about all of these different aspects that you obviously could not have known until you did the research?
You're absolutely right. Now, it was an overwhelming project to take on as an individual, and that was the early part of it, was the panic. How do I deal with this? First of all, the material, and also the idea that I wanted to do a very good job about a very important person in Alaska. And so I had to be very, very thorough and had to use all the skills I'd learned as a journalist and as a writer and checking everything. And I, part of what the reason for writing about him was, one, it was a great story. He was a hero. He was the protagonist that goes out into the unknown to take on a noble, lofty mission and comes back changed and also changes the world around him. So it was that classic hero story that I was drawn to. And it was also a chance for me to get to know him better, because though I'd lived and worked with them and traveled with them, he was a very complex man. He was brilliant, funny, impatient, irascible, a whole bunch of things. And I dearly loved him. I had great respect for him. And I just knew there was much, much below the surface that I hadn't seen or experienced. And it gave me a greater appreciation to see all the things they went through. And Aunt Betsy, too. Things that I didn't even think about, you know, how they got up to Alaska on the Alcan Highway when it first opened. That was a huge drill for them with two children and a Dalmatian. I mean, those things are just difficult, difficult things to do. And you just feel for them and say, wow, you just are amazed at what they did. And the other aspect of their story is they it gives you a sense of what can be done if you have determination and the grit to do it. And I think that's a very inspiring story, that they made such a huge difference and they were individuals too. So all that research made me feel much closer to both my aunt and my uncle and appreciate their lives even more than I did before, which is a tremendous appreciation.
I think a book could be written about Betsy.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, really, what she knew, what she saw, what she did, and her interaction with various associations, and she was so meticulous in being able to not just keep records on him, but also about what it was like in Alaska, both for women and for the men. But the interesting thing is that there wasn't that discrimination against women because it was a very harsh environment. It's like, if you can do the job, hey, go for it. You know, we're not gonna thumb our noses at you. Forget about it. We need all the help we can get. And it was very different from what women experienced in the lower 48. And it's something that I think is very, very significant. Do you think you're going to take on that challenge and write about her?
I think it's a little late in the day for that. So this is a book about my uncle, but as he said of Betsy, without her, it would not have been possible. And in part of the book describes, you know, her experiences along with it. She was a tremendous partner with him and made it possible for him to do what he did. He couldn't have done it alone, I don't think, or wouldn't, to the extent, be as successful as he was in doing what he did. Without her sometimes staying at home and doing the records and keeping track of the office and all that, and also being out in the bush with him on some of these clinics, it just depended on what stage of life they were in and how old the children were. He also had another very wonderful colleague by the name of John Spahn, who was a field optician, who early in the 50s started going out with him on these clinics, who was a godsend to him because he was a good, strapping man and a great friend, as he became a great friend over the course of time. And they went out into these villages, and both he helped do anesthesia for a while, even though he's an optician. I mean, they just did what they had to do to make things work. And Aunt Betsy was a huge part of it, whether she was behind the scenes or right on the scene. She also was very, in her own right, it helped make nursing a profession up there. Instead of just putting a woman in a white uniform and calling her a nurse, she had to go through a nursing training to be called a nurse. For a while, they depended upon nurses coming in from out of state who had nursing training, and they would be nurses. That's how she arrived. But for a while, the criteria for being a nurse was pretty minimal, and she helped establish that. So she had, in her own right, she went from being this shy little farm girl to being a force in her own right.
Mm-hmm.
So she was quiet, but she was very determined, and she was very skillful at what she did.
Amazing. There was a motto in his clinic: education, participation, and responsibility. And yes, we don't rely on the government, which I think was such a powerful, powerful statement, because they couldn't. The government, and this is something I think people in many parts of the United States have the same attitude. You can't depend on the government, yet there are so many people that will expect that. And here you have people saying, we can't rely on that. That is not going to happen. So we've got to be able to be resourceful ourselves. This is really part of the American spirit that I think is so significant and makes a difference. I think your book, you know, Answering Alaska's Call, shows, and that isn't all that long ago, how even today, resourcefulness is important. Being able to deal with adversity, being able to have the resilience to say, this too shall pass, but let's take care of what we need to take care of right here, right now. And being willing to have that sense of curiosity and constantly saying, I can do something differently. I'm going to go to places that other people choose not to go to because I am going to be of service in some way. And that for him, for Doc Fritz, that was very, very important. And that was very important to Betsy as well, his wife.
Yes.
They were both very committed. And she had been in nursing herself, but they both were very committed to making a difference in the sense of not being concerned about recognition, but saying, we've got a job to do. And this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. They're just it's a phenomenal book to read, and I think that you say in your subtitle, it's an intimate portrait of Alaska's legendary surgeon, bush pilot, and legislator, Milo Doc Fritz, and it is that, but so much more. I think it gives an insight into an environment that still exists very strongly today. And maybe not recognized as such, but it really is. It really is a rugged, tough environment of the American soul that I think is very, very precious and very, very special. Now, Linda, you have a website. It's lindafritz.com. You also have a newsletter that you put out, and that newsletter gives information about Doc Fritz and also so many other things, and people will find that they can sign up for that if they so desire at your website. I'm so delighted we've had this conversation. Thank you for being my guest.
I'm very happy to. I'm happy to share Milo's story and Alaska's story. I think it's very important, especially now, that the world needs to be reminded of heroism, and we need to be reminded that one person can make a difference, and that can affect all of our lives, to make our difference in whatever way we can.
I concur. Thank you again for being my guest. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, my goodness, we're coming closer and closer to the 1st of November, but before we get there, we're going to be talking with Michael Zajakowski. He has written The Owner's Manual to Life. We're going to be discussing that with him, and then we're going to be talking with Gail Papp. She's written a publication about her husband, Joe Papp, who for decades was the person who originated and ran the Public Theater in New York. This is about their public and private life. And then we're going to be talking about a subject matter that you don't hear very much about, and that is a death doula. Anna Marie Capel is going to be my guest. And then, of course, Halloween. And so for that evening shows, I'm going to have an abundance, yes, of spooky stories. And then November the 1st, that is going to be a very, very special beginning. So we will be putting out the newsletter on November the 1st, and you will be able to find out about all of the wonderful people that we will have as guests during that month. Also, I wanted to make you aware again of my television show. And we will have just finished our filming of two additional programs, and one program a month is aired, and there is so much going on. And all of these programs center around authors that I have featured on my show. And we have themes with each show. So we've got a theme about the world of the fiction writer. We are going to be talking about money. We have got so many different subjects that come up. Now, this is available to you. The television programs are available to you 24/7 up on YouTube. You can go to my network page. You'll find out about the links that you can connect with. Also, the television programming is on my website as well. So all of this being said, the Donna Sebo Show and Warriors for Peace has expanded into that television format. And as of right now, we're just doing one television show a month, featuring authors from around the world. And it's also the audio is aired on one of my daily programs of the television shows themselves. So it is going to sound different from my regular programming. And the television show is almost an hour in length, and also the audio will be uninterrupted with any commercials, and you will hear the commentaries of the guests. So I hope that you will check out the television shows. And then remember, if there have been radio shows that you have said, gee, I wish I could have listened in, remember, the archives are available to you. So keep those archives up front and realize you can go in anytime. Also, the player on my network page plays the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming. All of that, again, is made available to you 24/7. Well, we are going to be moving along with some subject matter that I think you will find interesting. And, well, that's just what you do. The show continues, and we are going to maybe provide you with some things you had not had an awareness of. Alaska, the land of the midnight sun. Oh, there are so many stories regarding Alaska. I thought I would share with you this evening some of the spooky stories, since we're in the month of Halloween this October. I really thought I would also share with you a marvelous recipe. So if you wanted to get a piece of paper in handy, this is regarding a fish that is dearly loved by Alaskans and many people around the world, and that is about halibut. And there's a wonderful woman that I did an interview with, Anne Chardonnette, and she put out a recipe book, and that is the Alaskan Heritage Seafood Book. And she had lived in Alaska for such a long time, and she's got a little bit of history regarding the halibut. And I remember when I was in Homer, Alaska, I was staying at the only place you could stay in at that time, which was a chain hotel that had been established in Homer because tourism, especially for fishing, was really a big thing. Well, I saw a photo of a halibut that weighed 800 plus pounds. Now, you can imagine bringing that big fish in with that kind of weight. Well, that photograph was proudly on display because it had been caught near the waters of Homer, Alaska. Well, what I found that made Anne's publication so fascinating is the information she gives relative to the native population and how often there are these recipes that people develop. And I've got one with macadamia nuts. It sounds exotic a little bit, but oh, it's wonderful. Now, this is information that she shared, and it was about halibut hooks and halibut clubs. Now, this was a part of the fishing gear whenever people wanted to go out and get halibut. And the native peoples, when they developed this gear, it was very ornate. It was beautifully carved. And among the Tlingit and Haida people, they had the hardwood fish clubs. And they said these were designs that you would often find on their bowls and their totems. And the clubs were 40 centimeters in length. Again, hardwood. That is very, very difficult to carve, but they felt that this led to very good fishing, but you had to be very skilled in the art of wood carving. And in 1787, there is a record of a Captain George Dixon who wrote about going halibut fishing with the tribal peoples in the Pacific Northwest waters and up in Alaska. And he said, they bait their hooks. And I'm quoting what was saved out of his commentary. They bait their hooks with a kind of fish or squid, and having sunk it to the bottom, because halibut are bottom fish, they fix a seal bladder to the end of the line as a buoy. One man is sufficient to look after five or six of these buoys. When he perceives a fish bite, he is in no great hurry to haul up his line, but it gives him time to be well hooked. And when he's hauled the fish up to the surface of the water, he knocks him on the head with the short club. And why they clubbed the halibut? Because they would stop struggling. And they're very powerful fish. And they said if they're very, very large, these fish were capable of breaking legs and damaging or even upsetting the canoe in its final struggle. And I will tell you, Anne actually caught a halibut, and she said it is really a collector's item, that blunt object that is called the halibut club. And in 1938, the Smithsonian did an archaeological expedition to the Aleutian Islands. And there is a woman who was a fisherman. Her name was Mrs. Woodbridge. And she is standing very proudly next to the halibut that she caught. So I thought I would share that with you. And then I wanted to share the recipe with you that Anne had put into her cookbook because it really is delicious. Now, Alaskans are known for their love of food. You will find fabulous restaurants if you go up into the Anchorage, into any area of Alaska, really. People enjoy their food, and they want good food. And when it comes to fish, they really know what they're doing. Well, Anne got this recipe from a particular place in Homer, and it's the Tutka Bay Lodge, and it's owned by John and Nelda Osgood. And John was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he will take people out on tours because that's what he does. And then they also feature local seafood, which, of course, has salmon, halibut, scallops, and crab. And this, what's interesting about this particular recipe is that you can make it an hour or two ahead before you cook it. And you have to refrigerate it, of course, but it really is very, very delicious. So what you're going to need is a cup of flour, 1 tablespoon of paprika, 1/2 tablespoon of garlic powder, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of white pepper. You're going to need 2 eggs, beat them well, 1/3 cup of milk. You can use water if you don't have milk handy. 1/2 cup of dry breadcrumbs, 1/2 cup of coarsely chopped macadamia nuts. You need 2 pounds of halibut fillets, and you want to cut them into serving pieces. And it makes 4 servings. And then 1 cup of peanut oil. And you might need extra as you're going to be frying these. Now, if you don't have access to macadamia nuts, you can use almonds instead. And what you do, your flour, your paprika, your garlic powder, salt and pepper, put it in a shallow bowl, and then your eggs and your water and or milk in a second shallow bowl, and then you have your breadcrumbs and macadamia nuts in a third shallow bowl. Now, what you do is not unlike fixing any kind of food that's going to be fried. You're going to dredge your fillets in the seasoned flour and then dip the flours in the egg mixture. Then you're going to coat it with the nut mixture. And you want to press the nuts into the fish. And then you're going to lay those fillets on wax paper or plastic wrap. And then your peanut oil, when you're ready to cook. Now remember, you can take the fish prepared, put it in the refrigerator, cover it snugly and with plastic wrap. And that's going to work just fine. And then when you're ready to cook it, you pour your peanut oil into a large skillet. You want that oil to be 1/4 to 1/2 inch in depth. And by the way, if you're allergic to peanut oil, then you can substitute another oil. Heat your oil to 375 degrees. That's very important. And then you want to fry those coated fish pieces for 2 to 4 minutes per side, and it'll turn beautifully golden. And you cook just until the fish is golden on both sides, and it's going to be opaque in the center. Then you drain it on your paper towels, and you're going to, of course, serve it hot. Now, dependent on if you have a nice big skillet, great, but let's say you have a smaller skillet. Well, then you want to make sure that you have your cooked pieces, if you cooked them 2 at a time. Again, it depends on the size of your skillet. So the bigger the skillet, the better, so that you can get all 4 pieces in at the same time. But if that's not the case, then just do 2. And then keep them warm in the oven. And you're going to find that they are just delicious, served with a salad. That is optimal. But then there is a tartar sauce that John has. And I thought, okay, I am going to share that with you because it's always good with fish to have a nice tartar sauce. So this is a tartar sauce that was developed by another Alaskan. He was one of those people that worked in the oil fields and in the pipelines on Prudhoe Bay, and he was worked there for many, many years. And he opened up his own restaurant in Valdez, and he is on the harbor, and this is a tartar sauce that really makes a difference. It's got a little bit of extra something in it, but I'll tell you what you're going to need is 2 1/4 cups of homemade mayonnaise, or you can just buy ready-made mayonnaise if you're a lazy cook like me. You're going to need 1/8 cup of sweet pickle relish, 1/3 cup of chopped dill relish, 1/4 cup of finely minced onion, 2 teaspoons of lemon juice, 1/2 teaspoon of Worcestershire sauce. If you like garlic, add a little bit of garlic, tasting it as you go along to make sure you don't overdo it. And then, of course, you can add some salt and pepper to your taste. He recommended white pepper. You just mix all the ingredients except your garlic, salt, and pepper. You mix all of the ingredients that I've mentioned. And then you carefully add garlic, if you like garlic. If you don't like garlic, forget about it. A little bit of salt, a little bit of pepper. And this keeps easily for about 2 weeks. I would say put it in a glass jar. Do not put it into a plastic container. Keep it in a glass jar. But I don't think it's going to last very long, because especially with fish, it is really going to be a favorite. And it is something that it's just wonderful. So I wanted to share that with you. And of course, because in keeping with the theme of Halloween coming up, well, we're going to share a couple of stories. And believe me, Alaska is loaded with stories. Everything from sea serpents to, well, anything, and Bigfoot. I mean, you've got all of these vista, you know, very, very unique stories. And this particular story relates to a Reverend Arthur R. Wright. Now, he was a missionary in Alaska in the early 1900s, and he was half Athabascan, and he was the son of a white man and an Indian mother. He had been educated by the church, and he just thought, even with his Athabascan background, that the stories of his people were just nothing but a bunch of hooey. Well, that doesn't surprise me. That happens with cultures around the world. They were just myths. They were just legends. However, the Athabascan elders share a story that was really significant, because Reverend Wright found that the myth was really the truth. It is the story of the Tail Men, and he relates this. In fact, it was originally published, this article, in the Cordova Daily News on February the 7th, 1924. I wanted to say it was the Tall Men, but they're really the Tail Men. Now, he was on a trip over to Copper River, and Indians that he met drew his attention to numerous holes in an embankment we passed. And it was very curious the way these holes were shaped and where they were located, and he asked them if they knew what they were caused by. And they said, oh, yeah. It's holes of men with tails. And this is the story that he was told. In the Salina River County, there were rolling hills on which numerous caravan roped. The Indians, who subsisted on meat, were lured to this district by the abundance of game. And years ago, at the mouth of the Salina River, they built a large Indian village. One day, a dog brought into the camp the tail of a fish. No one had caught any fish. And the Indians were puzzled as to how the animal got the fish. Well, their curiosity was very strong, and they decided they were going to search the very area they were in to determine if there were any other tribes. Well, they go out to search for the unknown people. When a number of the researchers did not return, the people that were back in the village knew that something was very wrong. What happened to the men? Well, finally, one of their most skillful trackers, he went out to search for the missing scouts. And he went through the country that they occupy, and finally he comes upon a hidden trail, and it was going through some woods. And across the path at intervals was stretched a rope that was made out of grass. Well, being an expert tracker, he's going to check it out. And he thought, this is a trap, an alarm. Well, he continued to follow the trail, and he found that he ended up in front of a group of caves, and they were a bit away from him, but he saw them regardless, and he was really being very cautious because he didn't know what he was going to be coming into. And as he got closer and closer, he saw something that really surprised him. Out of these numerous caves came men, and they all had tails. They all had the appearance of just like the men of his village, except they had a tail, and they were dragging it behind them. And he was surprised to see them use these tails as their chief means of locomotion. They curled their tails forward between their legs and recoiled in such a manner as to push themselves forward. Sounds a bit like kangaroos, don't you think? Well, the scout was watching them very carefully, and he made sure that he was keeping to windward to avoid being detected by a scent. They kicked what looked to him like a ball. On observing it more closely, the scout recognized, to his horror, the head of one of his companions. He was watching them rushing about, going to and fro, and they were just having a wonderful time playing ball with his head. He noted their number, the number of the caves, and returned back to his camp. He made his report to the villagers. There were a group of men and boys that got together, and an attack was planned on the village of the tailmen. They decided they were going to seal off the caves with fire and smoke and kill the people inside. It was raining when they reached the caves, and the tailmen were all inside, and each group of the villagers were assigned to a cave. With burning brands and brush, the Indians rushed the caves and plugged the openings. As they stood guard outside, through the fire came flights of arrows. Soon this stopped. After all signs of life from the tailmen had ceased, the villagers returned homeward. The tailmen were no more a menace to the Indians as far as they were concerned. Today, all that remains of them are this legend, their caves, and numerous arrowheads. Thus ended the story. And someday, in the article, he said, I hope to return and try to find out more about these tailmen. Whether or not Reverend Wright ever returned to those caves, nobody ever knows. But what a curious story to be able to pass along about a group of people that were just like humans, but had these unique tails that they used to propel themselves. Were they cannibalistic? Who knows? We don't know. But that is one of the strange stories of Alaska and the Yukon that Ed Farrell put together in a book of the same title. It is absolutely amazing what we can find out when we open up our minds and our attitudes and become friends with books. They're very special and they're very precious. Well, we'll be talking with you tomorrow. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Be well. We'll be talking again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.